Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to another Eastern Radio Talk Show episode, episode 34. Now, I apologize, my mic was turned off, so let me wish everybody a good evening again. EAL listeners, again, happy Labor Day. We're coming to you live tonight from Live Oak, Florida, Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts, Roaring Gap, North Carolina, and Jacksonville, Florida. Our hosts for tonight's show are Steve McDonald, Live Oak, Jim Hart in Martha's Vineyard, Steve Thompson in Roaring Gap, North Carolina, and Neil Holland, Bud Hescott, and me, Margaret Bars, in Jacksonville, Florida. Our producer is Eric Otero. He's also here in Jacksonville. Tonight's call-in numbers are area code 213-816-1611, and you may call toll-free, area code 877-572-1863. So let me repeat those numbers for you again. Area code 213-816-1611, toll-free number 877-572-1863. Now, tonight's show is open mic, so why don't you pull up a chair, pick up your phone, we'll talk about anything with wings. So do call in with your questions or just to add your thoughts about tonight's show.
Anything from airplane with the letter A in the alphabet to, I guess, Zeppelins would Zeppelin's be Z in the
Waco's
alphabet. Hey, I just thought of that.
Waco would be the step to the Z.
Yeah, there you go. And you guys, what have you guys got in mind tonight?
I have something, Neil, which is hot off the press. And you mentioned it earlier, Dateline Sunday, September 4, 2011 at 6:58 p.m. More than 100 American Airlines pilots chose to retire Thursday, 10 times more than the usual monthly number, motivated by potential declines in the value of their investment funds, their retirement funds. Pilot union officials expect the high rate of retirements to continue this fall, which could create operational problems for the carrier heading into the holiday travel season. For now, the Fort Worth-based carrier said the retirements do not affect scheduled operations. Spokesman Mrs. Casuno said American has some flexibility because of our reserves and the ability of pilots to pick up additional time. We will continue to evaluate our schedule needs in the coming weeks. Typically, about 11 pilots retire from the airline each month. This month, the figure is 111. The Allied Pilots Association, which represents American's pilots and its members, are concerned about the financial health of American and their retirement funds. With the downturn in the stock market, the value of pilots' defined contribution retirement plan, which has dropped significantly, and because the plan's rules set the value of the pilot's fund 60 days before the effective date of retirement, pilots who retired Thursday locked in their plan value based on the stock market values on July 1, before the market started sliding. We do expect this elevated retirement rate to continue this fall, Association Secretary Treasurer Scott Shanklin said, "We are monitoring it very closely. Most of the retired pilots were captains, and a significant number flew the Boeing 777, which is used by American on international routes," Shanklin said. And more pilots will have to retire starting on December 2012 because of the requirements of the Federal Aviation Administration. In 2007, the FAA increased the mandatory retirement age for pilots from 60 to 65, which led many of them to stay on the job a bit longer. The first group of pilots who will be forced to retire under the new requirements will hit 65 the end of next year. It takes 6 to 8 weeks to train a pilot on a new aircraft, and American has been recalling 30 to 40 pilots every month. Last year, the carrier announced it was recalling 250 pilots as it added international routes as part of its agreement with British Airways and with Iberia. That's the latest we have on this situation.
I've got something to comment about that. Now, I've learned a long time ago in aviation, you never jump out of a perfectly good airplane. Now, there's a reason why you're losing 111 people a month. There must be some scuttlebutt, or there must be some stuff being set through the ranks to saying, if we don't get out now, we might not have anything when we do get out. So something's afoot there, and I'm curious to see what it may be.
Well,
any comments from you guys?
Yeah, 100 pilots on American seniority list is, less than 1% of the entire seniority list. It's minuscule as far as retirements go.
Yeah, but this is going to be, don't you? If,
I'd say one person retiring early has got to have their brain examined.
Well, I think so, too. I think it's better to stay there no matter how bad it is. It sure is better than being on the other side of the fence wishing that we could jump back over the fence again.
Yeah. And a lot of us have gone that route before.
Oh, yeah. Even to the point I can't stand going to an airport anymore because you just don't want to see a grown man cry.
You know, Jim, you read in that article that it takes 6 to 8 weeks to train a pilot on a new aircraft. Now, that brings up another point. How are they training their pilots nowadays? Because there was an article here last week, as a matter of fact, in our paper here in Jacksonville, Florida, that pilots are having a problem with once the autopilot kind of kicks off automatically, they don't know how to recover the airplane. I mean, let's face it. How do you recover from a stall? I think we learned that in basic training, you know, in our first 8 hours of flying, how to recover from a stall. These guys don't understand how to recover from an airplane or an autopilot in this article, particular article that's in the newspaper. How to take over the situation when the autopilot kicks off and the airplane is in an unusual attitude. We also call that in flight training.
Does the link trainer give you any indication of what to do in those events?
Well, I think the link trainer has gone out a long time ago, Jim.
Well,
but
I mean,
the modern trainer, it's still a good word to use, link trainer.
Well, I think that the media is using a lot of license and rhetoric and saying 6 to 8 weeks. At Eastern Airlines, once you were on the property, it was 2 weeks of ground school and another week of simulator and a check ride. And that was, if you spent a month in training on a new airplane, you'd spend a long time on that airplane. So 6 to 8 weeks doesn't sound correct to me.
Yeah.
Except for perhaps a new hire.
Yeah, Steve Thompson, you've been in training before. You've been an instructor pilot, check captain, and so forth. The training that's being provided now for the pilot in order to recover from the situation such as existed in the Air France, I think it was Air France, over the Pacific Ocean, the fact that the co-pilot was flying the airplane, I think the captain had gone back to the back, and the co-pilot, not recognizing the situation, didn't really understand the attitude of the airplane when the autopilot punched out. What are your thoughts, Steve Thompson?
Well, there was another incident, of course, in upstate New York. It was a feeder airline that where the female co-pilot had very minimal experience, and neither of them had had any experience in icing, and it turns out that the icing was not the problem, as I recall the incident. But he just reacted totally wrong when the stick shaker went off, the stall warning went on, and he pulled back instead of, as we were all trained to do, from before we soloed. When you get into a stall situation, you add power and push forward. I can tell you, along with the situation we're talking about, I recall on the 10-11, we would get people upgrading to the 10-11 from the 757, and we scheduled one additional simulator period just so that they got used to flying a needle ball in airspeed. We had to have one additional simulator period, for people coming from the 757 just to teach them to fly instruments.
Yeah.
Now, the question I have is, how did these people get hired with this skill that they don't have? I mean, didn't they have to demonstrate their flying capabilities before they were employed?
Let me answer that. England and France, and I think Germany also, have a school that is dedicated to taking high school students, giving them an aptitude test. If they pass the aptitude test, they put them in this special school to teach them to fly, to put them through the airline's training program. They start from scratch. They end up in the right seat of an airliner that they are awarded during their training session, and that's where they come from. They don't come from a college background. They come from the airline's specific school. I know England, France, and Germany do this, and how much training they get in actual flying, in stick and rudder flying, I don't know. But it seems like the more we read about it, the more we understand that it's not happening. They're not getting the basic training. They're just getting the training in learn to fly, operate the computer. The computer will keep you safe. And
well,
put them in the seat, and there they are.
Yeah. Well, Steve, I can say that there's one lady that I know would be able to answer those types of questions of basic aeronautics or flying an airplane, and that person probably would be the one that I wanted Margaret to talk to us about tonight. She's a friend of mine years ago, and as a matter of fact, she's 101 years old. Margaret, tell us about Evelyn.
Well, her name is Evelyn Bryan Johnson, and actually they called her Mama Bird. And she was born in Corbin, Kentucky, which is actually maybe 5-6 miles from Hazard, Kentucky, where actually Lou Ann and I were born as well. And the interesting thing about her, she was just such a fascinating person. And she is the first female pilot with the most number of flying hours in the world. And actually in July of 07, she was inducted into the National Aviation Hall of Fame alongside astronaut Sally Ride. And so some of you may know some more about her, but I found her to be absolutely fascinating. Her list of credentials and her accomplishments just go on and on and on. And I love something that she said. I was reading a comment that she had made, and she said, "I never expected such honors. I only set out to enjoy the sky and the thrill of flying." So, special tribute to her today.
Margaret, I was there when she was installed there at the Hall of Fame.
Really?
About 5 years ago.
Oh.
And you're right. She was very modest, and I sat at the table next to her.
Oh,
I met Evelyn Johnson on a trip when I used to own a Stearman that, like Steve McDonald has now. But I had a Stearman, and I remember back in the 70s, I went up to Morristown, Tennessee, where my wife and her family are from, and we flew in with the Stearman, and we landed at Morristown, Tennessee, and there was Evelyn Johnson. I had just met her for the first time, and talking with Evelyn at that time, back in the 70s, she told me that she had been in aviation, and she'd flown airplanes for a long, long time, and I then realized that she was the second, I believe, at that time. As a matter of fact, I believe she holds the Guinness record today, if I'm not mistaken. But the guy that held it at the time that I met Evelyn was a guy in Montgomery, Alabama, and he flew pipeline patrol. His last name was Johnson. I cannot think of his first name, but his last name was Johnson, just like Evelyn's. And he flew a pipeline patrol. He would go out and come back in the same day just patrolling the pipelines for the petroleum companies. So he racked up a lot of time. And at that time, he was the Guinness record holder of more hours in the air than any person. And then Evelyn was second. Evelyn, the last time I saw her was about, I guess, 5 or 6 years ago. And she told me at that time, she lost her leg, by the way, in a car accident. So she has not been able to fly since that accident. But she is 100. Did you tell her? 101 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And her good friend, as a matter of fact, there's a connection here with Eastern Airlines. When I talked to Margaret, I had brought over to her a group of Boy Scouts that were qualifying for their Eagle Scout rating. And one of the things that the badge was an aviation badge, and I decided to bring them over and let them talk to Margaret. I mean, to not Margaret,
it's
but
okay,
Evelyn.
And
Evelyn gave them a good presentation of the airplane and so forth. But at that time, she told me one of her real, real good dear friends was Johnny Miller of Eastern Airlines. We all know Johnny Miller. At that time, was about the same age as Evelyn, in his 90s. And as you recall, if you were with Eastern Airlines, Johnny Miller was our first autogyro pilot, and he flew the mail from the tall buildings in New York City in the autogyro, the Eastern Airlines autogyro. So he flew his Bonanza. He used to go yearly, every year, down to visit with Evelyn, and they'd go out and have lunch together. And even in their 90s. So it's a very fascinating connection with Evelyn and Eastern Airlines. A remarkable lady.
Amazing.
We've got someone in area code 410. Would you press number 1 on your phone if you'd like to speak with us?
I've got a funny story about Johnny Miller if you want to hear it.
Yeah, go ahead.
Johnny Miller, when REPA had its convention in Atlanta in 1996, I guess it was, Johnny Miller got in his Bonanza, and he was in his 90s at the time, I think. He flew it from Connecticut down to Atlanta, and he went into Fulton County Airport. He had to shoot an approach because the weather was low minimums, and he landed the airplane, went over to Hill Aircraft, parked the airplane, and made arrangements for them to take care of the airplane, and then he says, I want to rent a car so I can go to the Eastern Convention. And they wouldn't rent him a car because he was too old.
Yeah, that's a true story. True story.
Came,
I remember
he came
that.
To the convention and he was hot. Oh boy, he was mad.
I can believe it.
Margaret,
area code 410. Do we have a caller? Area code 410.
Let's get a press 1 now in order for this to work.
Yeah, press 410 is down Lauderdale East Coast area.
Oh, it is. Okay.
I have a comment for this, Steve. I have a comment for Margaret, a story about Kentucky.
Yes.
I flew a charter trip in a Bonanza into Harlan, Kentucky. And
yes.
That's near Hazard, is it not, Margaret?
That is correct. You do not want to drive there after dark. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, that's true. And I'm not sure at that time when I flew a charter trip in a Bonanza in there that I wanted to go there, period, because I remember going downtown, walking down the street,
yes.
And I felt like if I made eye contact with another male walking down that street, that I would be dead in 5 minutes. I was never so nervous in my life as I was there.
Actually, that probably saved your life. It's always a good idea to be cautious. By the way, do you know in the state of Kentucky it's illegal for you to walk down the street with an ice cream cone in each pocket of your pants?
What?
No.
No, it's true. It's true. Apparently, back in the 30s, and I'm sure you've heard of Bloody Bertha, you know, that's the county next to Hazard. And
we've all heard of that.
A bloody breakfast?
Yeah, sure.
They used to have a fight. And apparently a guy came out of an ice cream store, had a cone in each pocket of his pants, and he picked the cone out, and someone thought it was a gun and shot him dead.
Oh, my God.
So, yes, that is on the law books. Yes. But
now I see why you didn't want to land in that airport.
But, Steve, I have family there, so if you're ever back there again, we got your back.
Okay, thanks.
Margaret, you have some information on Betty Skelton, and I believe we have Hal Nord on the line also that can tell us a little bit about Betty. But go ahead, Margaret.
Yes, I was looking on Saturday, and I really was just looking on the Internet. I don't know a lot about aviation and certainly, female pilots. And, about 2 to 3 hours later, I was still on the Internet, and I came across a lady by the name of Betty Skelton Erd. Am I pronouncing that correct, Hal? Is it Erd? Okay. And she just passed away. And if you read about her life, it was just absolutely incredible. And she was a retired land speed record car driver and acrobatic airplane pilot. She set 17 aviation and automobile records and was known as the First Lady of First, and helped create a lot of opportunities for women in aviation and auto racing and so on and so forth. And she was actually born in Pensacola, and I think when she was younger, she borrowed a Fairchild PT-19, and Clem Whiteneck taught her how to loop and roll, and she mastered that in about 2 weeks. And but what's so infamous about her, too, is she had a plane called the Little Stinker. And actually, that is now on inverted display at the Stephen F. Udvar Hazy Center at Washington Dulles International Airport, which is part of the National Air and Space Museum. And I thought we should just pay special tribute to her. And I know, Hal, you're going to read some information about her from her obituary.
Bring us up to date, Hal.
Okay. Betty Skelton was a champion aviator and a speed demon driver. I'm going to read off the obituary, who set records for flying in land speed and so impressed the original seven Mercury astronauts with her skills that they joked that she was number 7.5. She died Wednesday at age 85, was international feminine aerobatic champion for 3 straight years, starting in 1948. For a time, she made her living as a stunt pilot at air shows, where she was famed as the first woman to perform the inverted ribbon cut, flying her airplane, the Little Stinker, low and upside down. Now, the part that we might be interested in was that 1950, having achieved by age 24 everything possible for a woman flyer, M.S. Skelton turned to auto racing. She drove the pace car at the Daytona 500 and set land speed records in jet cars at Bonneville Salt Flats. Possessed of a model's good looks and flair for fashion, she went to work for General Motors as a test driver and advertising executive, coordinating car show presentations and posing for print ads for Corvettes and Corvairs. When the original Mercury astronauts made headlines in 1960, Look magazine sent her to take the same battery of tests as the astronauts took. She passed with flying colors. I want to skip here to the part where she worked for Eastern Airlines.
Eastern Airlines,
Yeah, and she took flying lessons, and soon the family was operating flight school in Tampa, Florida. She soloed for the first time at age 12, although surreptitiously. She didn't tell her mother for a week, she recalled, in a 1999 oral history for NASA. She soloed legally at age 19. By 17, had enough hours to qualify for the Women Air Force Review pilots, but the war ended before she could enlist, and she instead worked at a desk job for Eastern Airlines, receiving her commercial rating at 18. She was then certified as a flying instructor. The rest of it you can get. Patty Wagstaff, a champion U.S. aerobatic flyer, said Miss Skelton was as her inspiration in the generation of women pilots. She was really gorgeous, a really attractive girly girl, but we'd sit down and talk about breaking a land speed record or flying a warbird in a very matter-of-fact way. Wagstaff said, you're in a man's arena, and you show up in a dress. We're complex people. But anyway, I had the privilege of spending an afternoon at her home after she donated the airplane. It was north of Detroit. And I found her to be very hospitable, and she made me extremely comfortable.
Now, that was your personal meeting with her? At her home.
It's north of Detroit. I don't remember what the occasion was. I was alone, and I think I had just found out about it because I've been a fan of aviation history since day one.
Well, I think she would be a good candidate for the Florida Aviation Historical Hall of Fame.
Well, I was with Patty Wagstaff in Arizona at the Hall of Fame installation over there, and also when the previous lady was installed in the Hall of Fame. I was in Dayton at that meeting when she was introduced. Mrs. Johnson and Sally Ride came in on the same installation.
Evelyn Johnson was there too.
Yeah, she was. I sat at the table next to her.
Yeah, what a remarkable lady she is. Yeah.
Yeah, she lost her leg by then.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I just gave a signed edition that Evelyn gave me personally of her little book that is called Mama, and it's a biography of Evelyn Bryan Johnson, and it's just as a flight instructor. Mama Bird is the name of the book, Mama Bird, and a great little book. And she signed a personal copy to me and gave it to me. I forgot what year it was that I got this. It's 2001, so it's been 10 years ago.
I think she had 50,000 hours, Neil.
I think she's over 50 now. I think, well, at that time, I'm not certain. But I do keep up with her because my wife's family, every time there's an article about Mama Bird in the newspaper of Morristown, Tennessee, she sends it. They send it to me. And so I kind of keep up with it. But somewhere in here, it probably tells the number of hours that she has. But the book, it shows all of the people that she knew, and of course in the Tennessee Hall of Fame, Aviation Hall of Fame, she has 57,654 hours in the air. Margaret just pointed that out to me in the article. And the fact she was on Johnny Carson's show, she's been on a number of television shows, and so a remarkable lady. Just like Betty Skelton, and I think Betty Skelton, having her roots in Pensacola, Florida, would be a great candidate for the Florida Aviation Hall of Fame. But to change the subject, Steve Thompson came up with a point of discussion that I think is probably we would carry a few minutes here and talk about the CEOs. Can we all remember the CEOs chronologically, as they appeared after Eddie Rickenbacker? Eddie Rickenbacker then turned the reins over to the next CEO and the next CEO and so forth. So I think that's a good point of discussion here, Steve. And I think starting at with Eddie Rickenbacker, the person that comes to my mind as being the person that was selected was Malcolm McIntyre. Am I right or wrong?
That's my recollection also.
And, yes, he came from American Airlines.
That's correct. And it was interesting too because I was based in New York at that time, and I remember someone who was in a top executive who worked at another. They worked at, was it 30 Rock or
Rockefeller
Plaza?
10 Rockefeller Plaza.
10 Rock. Okay. someone who worked there with him. And as he told me then that Malcolm would, in the morning, they would have meetings and he would make a decision. And then he'd go to lunch. And that was, and I'm not inferring anything, but that was in the days where the two martini lunch sometimes turned into three or four. And he would come back in the afternoon and he would absolutely reverse the decision that he would make in the morning. And then after Malcolm McIntyre, I think, came Floyd Hall.
Okay, well, before
That's
we
right.
get to Floyd Hall, one thing that you mentioned also when you talked to us about this would be a good topic of conversation, was what was the main contribution of Malcolm McIntyre as the CEO of Eastern Airlines? So what would it be? Hal Nord, do you remember?
I know, too.
Higginbottom followed McIntyre.
No. Higginbottom didn't follow McIntyre. McIntyre, it wasn't McIntyre that gave us the air shuttle. It was an
Absolutely.
Eastern pilot. It was a Jewish name, Bernstein or something like that. It was his idea, and management ran with it. Do you remember who it was, Steve?
He was based in Washington, and he was a kind of a heavyset guy, and I do remember him. Who?
However, the point is that Malcolm McIntyre received the recognition of that.
That's right. And
Malcolm McIntyre's wife developed a cookbook that was distributed to all of the ladies at Eastern Airlines. That was his contribution.
The cookbook?
cookbook.
I'll go along with that.
The other famous thing about McIntyre was his nickname was Mac the Knife. He got together with C.R. Smith of American, and they tried to put together an American and Eastern merger.
Right.
And the CAB at the time, Steve, you correct me if I'm wrong, the CAB at the time put a stop to it. But McIntyre was involved in selling Eastern to American, or merging the two together.
Yeah. I recall that.
He was brought in for that reason. And Freddie Epson is the fellow you're trying to think of that gave the shuttle idea on the Constellations.
That's
Very
exactly
good.
Right.
Very good, Al. Excellent.
Yes, that's great.
Now let's move on from Malcolm McIntyre to the next CEO. Who was the next CEO?
Floyd
I
Hall.
Have it. It's Floyd Hall.
Floyd Hall, okay.
I'm not sure that's correct, but that's who I had down.
I believe it was. Okay, and what do we contribute Floyd Hall with his main contribution to Eastern?
Restructuring.
He brought Higginbottom with him.
Restructuring, but I think 15 years as president and CEO with Eastern, Floyd Hall did remarkable restructuring, you're right, of Eastern Airlines, I believe, at that time. Brought on Disney World came under the fact that he aligned Eastern Airlines with Disney World. So many airplanes were brought in to the Eastern fleet with Floyd Hall because of his 15-year tenure with the company.
But I think Floyd Hall changed our logo, remember?
Right, sure did. Anything else?
I really credit him with probably elevating the esprit de corps of Eastern Airlines more than all the other leaders we had put together.
I think you're right, Steve. I think he did a remarkable job of that.
I'd like to go back to I'm sitting here thinking that McIntyre was not the guy that came into office after Rickenbacker. It seems to me like it was either Lawrence Rockefeller for a little while, or maybe even Sid Shannon Sr. I don't remember, and I can't say for sure, but it just seems to me like after the bankers threw Rickenbacker out, that they brought their own man in, but it wasn't McIntyre.
Well, we'll have to look that one up for the next show and see if we can have someone to research that out and find out who it was. And from Floyd Hall, we came up with whom?
I have the colonel.
Floyd Hall was Lewis.
Lewis. Right, Steve Thompson?
Lewis came from Hawaiian Airlines. He was brought in order to give us the Trans-Pacific routes.
That was Arthur D. Lewis.
Arthur D. Lewis. That's right.
Arthur D. Lewis.
Right.
Very
he was
good.
Brought in. He was brought in to enable Eastern to get the, which we did. We did get the Pacific routes. Johnson awarded them to us, and Nixon took them away from us.
That's
in that 30-day period.
Yeah.
That's very accurate.
There was another name in there with Arthur D. Lewis. Came Wally Conrad, who was director of sales. And also George, oh goodness, we had a brand new vice president, George Gordon. George Gordon came from Massey Ferguson, and that has to do with my talk in a few minutes.
Okay, I don't recognize that as being an actual CEO or president or chairman of the board or anything like that. But if you remember that, then we'll do some research on that, Jim Hart.
Good.
And see if we can figure that he wasn't exactly CEO or president of Eastern Airlines. But after Arthur D. Lewis, who came?
Higginbottom.
Okay, yeah, Higginbottom.
Sam Higginbottom.
And where did he come from?
He came from TWA. He was the director of maintenance for TWA, and Floyd Hall brought him with us. Brought
yep,
him.
That's right.
When Floyd Hall came from TWA, he brought Higginbottom with him.
Okay, and he was maintenance, primarily a maintenance guy.
Right.
Do you recall how long his tenure was and what he was famous for as far as his time with Eastern Airlines with the as CEO?
Am I allowed to say what he was famous for?
Go ahead, Steve.
He was there about 3 years, I guess. Certainly not much longer than that. Borman had come on the property as a lower-ranking management type when Higginbottom was president. Higginbottom fouled the airline up so badly that there was a revolt of upper management in 1975, 76. And basically, upper management told the board of directors, and Lawrence Rockefeller at the time was chairman of the board, they told Rockefeller that you either get rid of Higginbottom or we're all leaving.
Okay.
And so they got rid of Higginbottom, and the choice then was between Bill Howard and Frank Borman.
And Bill Howard was an attorney.
What?
Bill Howard was an attorney for the company at the time.
He's the guy that should have gotten the job.
Well, you know, a lot of folks tell me that Rick Reivenbach was also considered a very possible choice as the president of Eastern. Do any of you recall that?
Yeah, Rick, after he left as vice president of, he was vice president of, he wasn't vice
flight
president
operations.
Of operations, he was vice president of flight operations training or something like that. The Eastern Airlines sent him to Kenya to be the president of Kenyan Airlines on a contract deal. And he was in Africa for several years and did well with that airline. And when he came back, he was just kind of out of the loop for going any higher at Eastern Airlines. But Rick spent his highest executive years in what's the city in Kenya?
Yeah, I think he would have been a great successor.
Tanganyika.
In that office.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where?
Tanganyika.
Okay.
No, that's not it. It was not Mombasa. Anyway, he spent several years over there, away from Eastern Airlines, in management, making that airline a viable airline over there, and he did a good job.
Yeah. After Higginbottom, then. I guess right after that was Frank Borman.
That's correct.
Is that the right sequence?
Yes.
Now, as I remember, Frank Borman was just a member of the board of directors before he was the CEO. Is that correct?
No, he was vice president of operations. Eastern had hired him in 1972 or 73, and they sent him to Harvard Executive Management School to get an education. Eastern paid for it, and he came back and he became the executive vice president for flight operations. And he was the guy that when Johnny Payne was the council chairman or was the negotiating chairman, and we had 747s at the time. Borman had come back from the school, and he walked in, and the negotiations were kind of stalled. And Borman walked in with a flourish, agreed with Johnny Payne with all the agreement, and the pilots got a really wonderful contract. And then a few months into the contract, Borman was walking around the operations in Miami, and the famous story comes back that Borman was making a comment about how sour he was about the contract that he'd signed with the pilots. And John Payne was passing through. He was flying the Kennedy to Miami to Chicago, 747 trip. And Borman says, he says, "I think you pilots are overpaid." He turns around and looks at Payne. He says, "Especially you 747 captains." And John, without even blinking an eye, turned and said, "Well, at least I wasn't stupid enough to fly around the moon on a colonel's salary."
Well, here was a guy who had never, never even ran a lemonade stand for profit, and here he is now running an airline.
Yeah, exactly right.
Right, yeah. He was an Eagle Scout, and he went around the moon.
Yeah.
But he never had any management positions, even in the Air Force.
Right.
Well, after Frank Borman and the post-Borman era, we came into the Lorenzo era. And, of course, not to get, off on that subject, but there were presidents after Borman and until the end of the demise of Eastern Airlines. And the first president after Borman was whom?
Was it Joe Leonard?
Richard Grove.
No, it wasn't Joe Leonard.
Marty was the end. Toward the end. He was the last guy. I think it was Joe Leonard.
No.
Oh, that's right. Sure it was.
Or Bates. Bates was after Leonard?
After Leonard.
No, it was because my retirement certificate is signed by Forklift Joe.
Joe Leonard. Okay.
So you're right, Joe. You're right, Steve. That's who it was.
Now, where did we get Forklift Joe? Where did we get that name, Forklift?
He was the vice president of maintenance at American Airlines that invented the procedure for changing the engines off a DC-10.
That's right.
And the DC-10 in Chicago was attributed back to Joe Leonard.
So they called it Forklift. And then after Forklift Joe, then we had Phil Bates.
Marty Shagru.
No, Phil Bates.
Bakes.
Phil Bakes, that's correct.
Okay.
I could tell you a story.
I don't know anything about him.
Well, I could tell you a story about me flying a trip. I'm going to tell you anyhow. I'm just in a mood to tell you about this. I had Phil Bates' wife and son on a flight going to Washington, D.C. out of Miami. And they were going up for some kind of Senate hearings. And they were going up to listen to the hearings where Phil Bates was to testify before Congress. And I had him on my airplane, and so I told the flight attendants, I said, or the flight attendants actually told me that they were on board the airplane, 757 going into Washington National. And I picked up the microphone without keying the microphone, and I said, "Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to recognize the fact that we have two distinguished guests with us this evening that have come from Miami up to Washington. And they are the wife of the president of Eastern Airlines, Mrs. Phil Bates, and her son, Master." But at any rate, they cut me off short there, and that was the end of the story.
I don't get it.
That was the end of the story.
That's my story. I never get any of these.
Okay, we're having fun tonight. Hey,
Neil, his name was Bakes, B-A-K-E-S.
Right? I know it, but it sounds like Bakes. Right. It was B-A-K-E-S.
You're a terrible person, Neil.
Yeah, I know it. But at any rate, I just had to throw that in. True story. Yeah. But it's been interesting, very interesting to talk about the presidents of Eastern. And now I wonder how many people can remember the presidents of Eastern before Eddie Rickenbacker. Steve Thompson, can you remember?
I sure can't help there because I was just an eye in my dad's...
yeah, twinkling in the eye.
Twinkling my dad's eye. I don't know.
Phil, I know Steve McDonald knows.
Was it an Orville Wright?
No. Way to go, Jim. Well, how about let's start off with Harold Pitcairn. Can we start off with Harold Pitcairn?
Okay.
Even though he was not with Eastern Airlines, he was with Pitcairn Aviation and sold the airline to Clements Keys. And do we know who the first president of Eastern Air Transport was?
You mean after Clement Keyes?
Yeah.
Wasn't it Sid Shannon?
No, it was not. I'll let you do some research on that. But it was not Sid Shannon. As a matter of fact, Sid Shannon, I don't believe, was ever the president of Eastern Airlines or Eastern Air Transport.
We had
Charlie Dolan, and we had a guy named Doe, D-O-E, his last name.
Why don't you give it to us, Neil, so we save time?
Okay. Well, now I'm gonna make you go to your research books and look it up, and you probably – but there were only about two or three presidents before that. I can't remember his first name, but his last name was Doe. I want to say it was Charles Doe, but that's not right either. But Doe was the first president of EAT, Eastern Air Transport, and then Dolan followed him as president of Eastern Air Transport. And then, of course, Rickenbacker didn't come along until North American bought into it, and he was made the general manager of Eastern Air Transport, and then he purchased the airline and became the president and the owner of Eastern Airlines with the corporation that was purchased. He remained president up until the time he handed it over to McIntyre.
Yeah.
There was a story that I read, which was very heartwarming, about a gentleman living in somewhere in Florida, and that every morning for many, many years, just after sunrise, this elderly gentleman would go down to somewhere on the beach in Florida near where he lived, walking, and he would go down and feed the seagulls. And the story was very heartwarming as I read it, and toward the end of it, it told the name of the man who did that. And can anybody, any of you, think of any person that we've talked about tonight who that might be attributed to?
Well, it was none of the people that we talked to about tonight.
Before you answer this, Steve, your answer is a hoax.
Yeah. It is a hoax.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Yes.
It was in Reader's Digest. Anyway, Charlie Dolan was a prominent member of the Lafayette Escadrille.
That's
and
good.
I had a,
Very
I
good.
Have a seven. Yeah, that's cocktail information. But
oh, that's
I met
true.
I met his grandson years and years ago when I was living in New Hampshire, just by chance. And Charlie, he gave me copies of a seven-page article on Charlie Dolan. And I had no idea that he was with Eastern until I was scrounging through the histories there at one of the repartee dinners, or the repa dinners. He was quite a guy.
What did Sid Shannon have to do with the airline?
I think he was a VP, but I don't think he ever attained the CEO rank or COO.
it's my understanding, my memory, that he hired Merrill.
Well, he may have, but he probably was the operational vice president of ops, but never that high.
The first president of Eastern Airlines was Charlie B. Doe.
Thomas B. Doe.
Okay.
We've just looked it up.
And Thomas Elliott, Harold Elliott, was the vice president, the next in line vice president of flight operations, period. And then after that, it was Dolan that was the president of Eastern.
Are we talking around the year of 1929,
30?
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
1930, 31, 32, 33, in that era, yeah.
Very good. Thank you.
Yeah. But go ahead.
The total life of Eastern was
it had to be
40, 50 years.
When was Eastern started? If we count Pitcairn as the original origin, the roots of Eastern Airlines, which was, I guess, Pitcairn. Steve McDonald, do you remember?
Well, the original flight was five flights on May 1st, 1928.
Male flights. Yeah.
That was the original day. Wait a minute.
What date?
May 1st, 1928.
Okay. All right.
And that was Gene Brown, I believe.
Well, he was one of the six.
Yeah.
Okay.
According to my Android, Eastern Airline has a history that dates back to 1927.
27, you're right.
Pitcairn Aviation, a mail carrier.
Some people date it back to 1926 and Florida Airlines, which...
Right. Exactly.
If you look, it kind of remotely fits into the picture. So maybe 1926 and Florida Airlines.
And then the last day of operation, that's a good question, Bud. Bud asked, what is the last day of Eastern's life was what?
April? January 31st, 1991.
Okay.
That's true to an extent. In Chapter 11, Eastern Airlines has never left Chapter 11, and as of this date today, Eastern Airlines is still in business.
Well, you're right, because the entity is still alive.
Good point.
Eastern has an executive office down on Brickell Avenue, downtown Miami. The guy that's the president now is getting $35,000 a month to be the
Ed Weigel is the president.
Who?
Ed Weigel.
Okay.
And Ed Weigel is the president of Eastern, the new Eastern Airlines, and speaking of the new Eastern Airlines, I think maybe we ought to talk a little bit about, in the remaining minutes that we have, about the possibility of Eastern Airlines becoming airborne again, rebirth of Eastern. And I hope that happens. Now, I was told by Ed Weigel, the president, the new president of the surviving or the entity of Eastern Airlines, the corporation, when I was down in West Palm Beach, Jim Hart?
Yes, right, Neil.
Opelika.
Yep.
And we had the flight down there, and Ed said that they are hoping that they will be back in the air by the beginning of 2012, January of 2012. But I haven't heard much lately about what the status is as far as the DOT certification of the airline, because we know the two processes, main processes to get an airplane in the an airline in the air is the DOT certification and then the FAA certification of the airline.
And what are the two requirements required to have an airline?
Well, the DOT is the fitness. We want to find out if you're capable financially.
No. I'm saying what are the requirements from the airline itself in order to charter yourself as an airline? There's only two things that are required, absolutely cannot be changed.
Go ahead, tell us.
The two things are a certificate on the wall and a chief pilot.
Yeah. Well, those are the two things. But the process to get a certificate on the wall and a chief pilot.
Oh, I understand.
Process of being DOT certified, Department of Transportation, certification, fitness. Are you financially able to fly this airline? I've been through that. I tried, as a matter of fact, I helped. We put an airline in the air in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, by getting the DOT certification first and then the FAA operational certificate to fly the airplane. Are you able to fly the airplane? First, are you fit to fly it? And then second, are you able to fly it? And the able part of it, it would be actually the equipment, the maintenance, the required personnel of the airline, and the fact that you've got all of your manuals and so forth that are approved by the FAA. So there's quite a bit of going through. That's the longest process. And then actually the route award, you've got to prove to the FAA that you can fly the routes that you intend to fly in order to be certified.
But Neil, there's a real a big one there, and that is, where in hell do you get the passengers? And I was involved in marketing.
Tell us
in
about
marketing.
That, Jim.
What?
Tell us about that.
Well, I was involved in marketing for 11 years. And I'll tell you, you have to determine where you're going to get your passengers. Are you going to get them from travel agents? Are you going to get them from other airlines, which is very important to our connecting patterns? And are you going to get them, through any other advertising type of work that we used to do? You might remember way back in the 60s, when we had the Happy Holidays promotions. That thing raised millions of dollars for Eastern Airlines. But you had to have a group of people promoting it through a number of different areas. You had sales reps on the road. They would visit commercial firms. They would visit travel agencies. They would have all kinds of other promotions taking place. And you've got to raise the passengers' interest. And I'll tell you, I've talked to a number of people now telling them that, hey, maybe Eastern might start up again. And they said, my goodness, tell us when.
Great. Now, tell me, do you think that it's going to be profitable now that they've taken away the commission of the travel agents? Do you think we're going to get the travel agents to get us the business?
No, no. In fact, I think what we're going to have to do is give the travel agents a little bit of a small commission, maybe 1-2%, which no one gives these days. As
true.
You know, most of the airlines just forgot about the travel agent, so the travel agent has now geared itself toward the cruise lines.
Yeah, the cruise lines, yeah.
The cruise lines, right. But I'll tell you, if we can find something that will bring those people back to us, I think it'd be one hell of a good deal. I would love to take part in something like that. We had the director of agency sales, his name was Trond, T-R-O-N-D, Sundum. And Trond Sundum had an assistant by the name of Bud Schultz. And those guys went throughout the entire United States, and every travel agent knew them by name. And the best thing we could do is to go to the American Society of Travel Agents, ASTA, A-S-T-A, which is the largest group of travel agents in the world. And that's where we ought to start, at least, to get the name known as soon as we know what we're going to do.
I can't believe that the time has gone so fast in this tonight's show. It's amazing. You guys have been so informative tonight and so interesting, the discussion, our talk. But I want to say, please be with us for those. We're going to sign off now, but be sure to tune in next Monday at 7 p.m. when Eastern Flight 35 will be departing from the gate, and we'll have another exciting show, an interesting show like we've had tonight for all of you folks that follow our Eastern Radio show. That's our show for tonight, folks, and we hope you've enjoyed it. So the Eastern Radio Show and the Eastern family will say that where all the women are unequal and all the men are good looking and all the children and grandchildren above average will say good night.
Good night,
good night,
everyone.
Good night, Eastern family.
Good night, Roy Gap.
Martha's Vineyard says good night, everyone.